Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tomorrow is Veterans Day, and while the U.S. involvement in the war in Afghanistan has come to an end, there are still thousands of U.S. servicemen and women in harm's way on yet another Veterans Day. All of them volunteers, and some, maybe even many, from multi-generational military families, where military life and the desire to serve is ingrained from an early age. It was certainly the case for my guest today, Jared Alexander. He grew up on military bases ranging from the American South to Utah to Japan. He was an Air Force kid, but he joined the Marine Corps to test his mettle and serve his country. He served in Iraq during the Sunni uprising and learned that his childhood dreams were a fantasy. Now a writer and journalist, he has written for Esquire, The Rolling Stone, and The Nation. Alexander writes about those childhood dreams and the all-too-real reality of war in his memoir, Volunteers, Growing Up in the Forever War. It's published by Algonquin Books and critically examines how the desire to serve, to help his country, collided square on with the realization that his service was in pursuit of an unwinnable war. And as he looks back on his youth, he says his proximity to the military and the imagery and Hollywood stereotypes of military service that surrounded him were the key factors in developing those expectations, not his family. Jared Alexander joins me today to talk about his book, Volunteers. Jared Alexander, welcome to Studio Tulsa.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, as we approach Veterans Day, I think there might be a consensus among Americans that this may be the first time since September 11th that our military forces are out of harm's way with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. But that's not true. There are nearly a dozen military deployments ranging from trainers in Iraq, peacekeepers in Haiti, interdiction efforts around the Horn of Africa, as well as sailors on deployment around the world. What would you like the average Americans to think about and speak out about this Veterans Day?
I would like them to just get involved with our foreign policy, to understand why we have troops forward deployed and continue to do so. I think that the best way to sort of honor veterans, quite frankly, is to be a little bit more discerning and a little bit more engaged with the situations that, quite frankly, create them. That would be that's honestly the best thing I can ask of anybody to participate in.
Yeah. There's been much written about the divide between American culture and American military culture, and your book really writes from the inside out to the rest of us. What do you want people to know about this culture?
It's us. The United States military is a cross-section of the people of the United States. It is not a separate entity. We as Americans enlist or commission into the military, and we serve for the amount of time that we do, and then we leave it, and we try to get on with our lives to a degree. And we own our military. It is filled, its ranks are filled with average Americans. We're not terribly exceptional other than the fact that we're doing something that can be exceptional. So I think we need to start taking ownership of our military and recognizing that it's not a separate entity from the country, that it is us. And the military and its wars, the wars that it fights belong to us.
Unfortunately, it seems like in this last 20-year period, there has been a big disconnect between American culture writ large and the families that are military families or have people in the military. It was almost like there were two dual societies living this last 20 years for a good part of it.
I agree with that. I think that's true. The history of that is somewhat long, but in short, you know, once the draft ended, Americans no longer had an obligation to, you know, be engaged with how the military was being used because it didn't necessarily affect them directly. Especially as our foreign entanglements increased and the ways in which our military were sort of in service to causes that were outside of our country, the average American just didn't really have a need or even, quite frankly, sometimes even a desire to engage with the subject because it would never impact their lives directly. And I think that that's what's caused this sort of widening, you know, divide between the two forces of our country, the civilians and the military.
You know, with a title like Volunteers, I really kind of expected the book to tackle that idea of this divide in culture that because of the volunteer force, our political leaders, our military leaders, have been more likely to use military force in situations where if it was a whole cross-section of everyone serving, it would be a very different decision. Do you ever touch on that in the book, or is that was that a subject you wanted to touch on, perhaps even obliquely?
I do it a little bit. I do kind of tap into that toward the end. And I've been exploring that lately, in fact, looking at the sort of overarching history of the country over the past 20 or 30 years. So like I mentioned earlier, the draft ends and then we go into a volunteer military. And initially, I think our government was very discerning about the conflicts it fought in. We don't want another Vietnam was a phrase you heard a lot. And over time, though, at least especially post 9/11, that language went away. We didn't hear that anymore. Like we became a little bit more loose in how we apply military power overseas. And that's because nobody was holding them accountable for it. You know, there was a little bit of protesting at the beginning of the Iraq War, but it became normalized, and that war went on until 2013. Afghanistan was far more normalized. It was sort of put under the back pages of our culture and kind of left there to stew. You know, a lot of people were upset. Well, there was a lot of folks who were upset about the withdrawal from Afghanistan and how clumsy it was. But to me, quite frankly, it was not surprising. And we sort of phoned in that conflict from the start. And then, so there was no reason to expect that the withdrawal was not going to be phoned in as well.
How did that affect you as serving in the military? You were a Marine from 1998 to 2006, and you served all over the place. How did that affect you that there was this disconnect, that American people were basically getting on with their life and not really paying attention to, you know, only marginal attention, I guess I should say that, when war flared up, when the insurgency flared up. But really, it was not first in mind.
You know, I have a tendency to be a bit, cynical is not the right word, I think, but more, I have an understanding of the culture as it relates to war. So I wasn't terribly moved by the lack of disinterest. I understood it. Politics is local. If it doesn't affect us locally, we have a tendency to avoid it. Or it becomes an elective choice rather than an obligatory one. So I wasn't terribly surprised by the general disinterest in what was going on over there, or the, you know, somewhat hypocritical rage when it all sort of collapsed on itself. I took it somewhat academically, to be frank.
Well, let's talk a little bit about volunteers. Volunteers combines stories from your time in combat in Iraq, some very vivid stories of serving under fire. But it also combines a lot of the story is the story of your growing up in Air Force culture. Your parents, your stepdad were all military, in fact, Air Force. Older relatives also served. You write that your earliest alarm clock was the F-16s taking off from the base where your family lived. Yeah, so you were totally immersed in military culture from your very earliest memories. What was that experience like? And why did you spend so much time on that childhood to explain how you ended up in Iraq in an insurgency?
Well, one of the things I had sort of noticed in the canon of war literature is that it didn't really talk about the formation of a soldier. And I wanted to, initially my intent was to write about the war, just specifically that. And it's a very old story in our culture now. And as time went on and as I sort of matured as a writer, I began to understand that what was missing was the childhood aspect of that, playing guns and playing war and sort of idealizing the people who do those sort of things, which was big in my childhood. And I think, and it was big in the childhood of a lot of friends of mine, especially veterans who, you know, they were motivated by it. They were excited about it. They were surrounded by it sort of machinery. And I was too, you know, like you mentioned, you know, the alarm clock effectively, you know, that, you know, I'd wake up and look out my window and watch fighter jets taking off into the sky. And those jets were meant to, you know, drop bombs, and they were meant to shoot planes out of the sky. They were not, you know, airliners. They were violent weapons. They were tools. And there is an attraction to that. And I think that we have to explore that a little bit as a culture and understand what is it about those things? What is it about war that makes it, why is it so enticing for people to want to do that? Not just from a national level, but also from an individual one. And that's sort of what angled me toward childhood, because that's where those ideas are formed, I think, to a large degree, at least, and especially well with me.
And, you know, you write about, of course, being on a base. Anytime the base opens up to the public, it's, you know, there's sort of these public relations days where, you know, kids get to sit in a Humvee, or I think at one point you got to shoot a machine gun.
That's right.
Or sit in the cockpit of an F-16 briefly. How indoctrinating were those sort of moments?
I think they were they just added fuel to what was already there. Those experiences just sort of fortified what I was already interested in. They added a little bit of imaginary fodder, if you will. You know, a kind of, I could take those experiences and I can apply them to my, you know, fantasies, if you will, about serving in the military, about doing those things. But I think that the core interest was going to be there regardless of whether I was on a military base or not. It just happened to be that I was exposed to it more directly than somebody who wasn't in that environment. And also, it probably limited my worldview in terms of other opportunities and other things that I might have been interested in. I mean, writing as a kid was interesting to me. I mean, other art forms, but it was overshadowed by this desire to want to be around the things that I was being exposed to.
Growing up on base or in base housing, your whole universe is this military culture. How did you view the outside culture, like when you're at school or when you're in other social settings growing up? Was the divide apparent even off base?
It was. It really was, but it was a lot more subtle, and it was a little bit, you know, it was under the radar a little bit. You know, military base housing is effectively like a suburb. I mean, it operates very similar. It just happens to be a little bit tighter in terms of community. But yeah, you know, the minute I left the base, the elementary school where I went to school in Utah was right outside there was the perimeter, the fence perimeter, and there's a gate that exited into the school. So the majority of kids who went there were military kids, but there were some that were not. And it was always a little, you could feel a little bit of a difference there. You know, one, access was hard for them. They couldn't get on the base. So, for instance, my mother had a good friend who lived out in town, and I believe she lives in Roy. And, you know, we would have to go visit them. They could never come to visit us. Mm-hmm. And that's just by virtue of the Air Force and the security measures. But there was definitely a very sort of, you know, there was a feeling of sloppiness we had about people who weren't in that circle, or maybe just a little bit of, it wasn't disdainful necessarily, but it was, we had a very, very powerful tribe, and it felt like perhaps they didn't. Now there was no judgment on that necessarily, but it was, you felt that distinction, that very, there was a very hard line between those two.
Really, in a way, you grew up in a gated community.
Yeah, there's some truth to that in certain respects.
My guest today is Jared Alexander. He's a former Marine who served from 1998 to 2006 in posts ranging from Iraq to East Africa. He's written for Esquire, Rolling Stone, and The Nation, among other publications. His new book is titled Volunteers, Growing Up in the Forever War. It's published by Algonquin Books. And it combines stories from his time in Iraq during the insurgency with growing up in a military family. Well, how much of your desire to serve came from your family or from the cultural representation of the military that you were surrounded in on base and through media?
You know, my parents never really made it a military service was not obligatory to my parents. If I chose to do something else, they would support that. But what really drove me was how it was represented in our culture, both in very realistic and honest ways, and also in quite frankly, jingoistic ways. I mean, my early films I watched, you know, prolifically were the 80s era action films. You know, I'm thinking of like Top Gun and Iron Eagle and anything with Arnold Schwarzenegger in it, quite frankly. Look, I have a rule in my house, if Predator's on, we watch that. Like, I love that film to this day. but those sort of films had a huge, created a foundation for me. And then I got introduced to Platoon when it first came out, and Hamburger Hill. And then in the 90s, I got fed, I was saturating myself in the literature of that period. Because, you know, through the 80s and 90s, there was this huge proliferation of literature about Vietnam that right. was coming out, sort of reckoning with that war. And I ate up a lot of it. I was really fascinated with Vietnam as a teenager. And then eventually that fascination grew into World War II and other conflicts. But yeah, I think a lot of it, the real motivation came from art. From Western art about warfare. That was the largest motivator. And then, of course, our media, the way it represents it, like I, you know, the Persian Gulf War was, I watched it live effectively as a kid. It was really in my face, so to speak, both because my stepfather was there. And so that has ramifications on me as a kid, but also because it was so heavy in our culture when it was going on.
What was that like knowing your stepdad was over there? Probably in Kuwait, I guess, or maybe in Saudi Arabia, for that matter, an Air Force base, you know, and watching the war unfold live on television, you know, Bernard Shaw and Peter Arnett, you know, huddling under a desk as Baghdad goes up, bombs and anti-aircraft all over the place, and watching it live on television.
Right. It was, you know, my stepdad going to the Persian Gulf. He went to the Emirates. Ah. He was a part of the first wave of Air Force units to go overseas. The 388 Tactical Fighter Wing was the initial aviation U.S. aviation unit to go overseas to set up defensive operations in case Iraq decided to come into Saudi Arabia. And so he went very early. I mean, I think the war starts in August 2nd. He was there maybe 2-3 weeks later. And, you know, that was really rough as a kid. You know, it's tough to be, to, you know, deployments were not a, at least in the Air Force, by virtue of kind of how it operated at the time, deployments were not a regular occurrence. They just did not happen a lot. You know, my stepdad probably, I don't think he deployed at all my entire childhood up to that point, with the exception of a few weeks to a school. So when he ends up going, it was stressful. You know, our family kind of got shut down a little bit. We kind of became numb to it. But as the war went on, as the defense, you know, Operation Desert Shield went on, and it looked like, you know, we were going to start combat operations over there, it became really interesting to sort of learn about. And then when the war started, I remember I was walking home from school. It was a very cold day in January, and a friend comes running down, "Hey, there's bombing." We go running back to the house, and we're sitting on his living room floor watching the really, you know, early digital video, night vision, you know, as all the AAA was going into the sky. You mentioned Arnett, and hearing Arnett and the other correspondents in Baghdad describing the scenes, it was absolutely mesmerizing to watch that, and really awe-inspiring. It was, wow, you know, my stepdad is involved in that in a small way. His responsibility was to repair the maintain the heads-up display on fighter jets. And so he had a little piece of that, and it was wild to watch. It felt like he had a tether to a piece of history to a certain extent.
We were talking earlier about where the desire to serve came from, and what I've, from your reading, it was not necessarily your family. In fact, your father had pretty much soured on the military. I'm gathering that really there was no push, and I think from the outside looking in, we think when we see a military family, you know, a lot of family influence in when a person decides to join the military.
Yeah, you know, my grandfather was in the Air Force. My stepdad's father was in the Air Force. My dad was in the Air Force. It was really prolific. There was a lot of, you look at the percentage of people who enlisted in the military, and a large percentage of them can draw a straight line to a family member who served in a war or in the military in general terms. It is very it's become increasingly generational.
But really, there was no push from your family, or did you feel?
Not really.
Was there an unspoken feeling, or
not so much? I think that there was a natural inclination. I think there was a natural assumption that I would end up there by virtue of my interests. But if I had if I had another way of going, if I had an interest in another subject, I would have taken that, and they would have supported that. So it wasn't a demand to enlist. There was none of that. You know, I never had any of that. And I don't know too many kids who had parents like that. But if I had that interest, they were certainly going to support that.
Can I ask you about writing about Iraq? I would imagine that is and still remains a tough experience. You've been a writer for a long time, but still deciding to write about your experiences in Iraq, about the people that you have to be close to, even if you didn't even like them, you're still incredibly close to them. What was that experience like?
You know, that was actually the initial intention of the book, as I mentioned earlier, was to be a book about Iraq specifically. And it took a little bit of, I needed to get some objective distance from it. And so that's what I spent a lot of time doing. I had written something many years earlier, and it did not do well. It was badly formed and just not well put together. And I ended up shelving it for a number of years. And I did that so I could kind of learn how to write effectively. And then I went back and I started writing about the war again. And what really helped me was I initially tried to approach it very much like a journalist would. Like, okay, let's look at my experience as if I'm reporting it, instead of just writing about it as if I'm a participant. And that helped me get some distance. And once I had that, then I was able to pick and choose how to tell the story. I was able to be a little bit more discerning as a storyteller, and making decisions that were more about the reader's experience rather than me just blathering on the page about what I think is important about the war.
What was it important for you to convey about your service in Iraq? There are encounters with IEDs, there's encounters with snipers, there's skirmishes that you describe. What did you want to convey?
I wanted to show, Carl Marlantes, the author, has a great quote, and he says, a lot of people assume that the military turns kids into killing machines. Well, it doesn't. It's a finishing school. And I wanted to kind of show that a little bit. I wanted to sort of break down the sort of attitudes that we have about the military in a certain sense. These are regular Americans or just regular people in terms we want to expand it up to include war in general terms, who are then, trained in a certain way to behave in certain ways. And a lot of those ways are violent when they need to be. And I wanted to sort of demonstrate, one, there is a lot about combat that is really, it's a spectacle. It's loud. It's very exciting in points. And I wanted to kind of demonstrate that. I wanted to try to show why that is for some folks, and me included, quite frankly.
Now, you come from a whole line of Air Force veterans. How did you end up in the Marines?
Yeah. Well, the Air Force, as I became a teenager, the Air Force really didn't offer me a role where I felt like I was going to be on the front line. There's not a lot of roles for that, unless you're, a fighter pilot, or there's a couple of other jobs that are really specialized that can do that. But they're kind of few and far between. And I became really interested in just the average combat soldier, just the guy with the rifle on the front line somewhere. Well, that job is reserved for the Army and the Marine Corps. And the Army was a little bit weird about putting me into the infantry. And I think they had to deal with the fact that I had I talk about this in the book. They had sort of a mentality about infantry that was really reductive. And
you go to the infantry when you don't qualify for anything else, right?
Right. Their sort of attitude was, we only put the dumb kids in infantry. And I thought that was a terrible, terrible attitude to have. You could look through our history and find incredibly brilliant and bright people who served in the infantry. And I had a lot of struggles with that. And I was a little disappointed in the Army. Granted, this has to do more with the recruiters that I have, and I don't want to disparage the entire branch because of my experiences in that context. But the Marine Corps, did try to push me in other directions. But if I wanted the infantry, they were going to give it to me, and they did. And I'm grateful for it. I'm glad I had that experience, as tough as it was at times. I idolized the Marine Corps in my childhood to certain points. But they really made it they had a way of making it attractive. It wasn't enough that you wanted to join. You had to prove that you wanted to be there, or prove your worth to that organization. And as a kid, as a teenager, that was huge to me. That was really attractive.
Can I ask you, you said you were grateful for the experience of being able to serve in the military, in wartime, in a war zone. Why are you grateful for that?
I, as bad as those wars are, and as dubious as the origins of those conflicts and the ugliness of the reasons why they were sustained or the absence of reason, I got to be around folks and other Marines who were just fantastic at what they did. I got to see incredible bravery, and I got to see a lot of compassion, quite frankly, from a lot of people who probably wouldn't be considered compassionate in our culture. And I just got to experience a lot of, while ugly things at times, one thing we have to understand is the 8 years I spent in the Marine Corps, I would say probably 1% of that, if that, was spent under fire. Mm. And I would say it's probably far less than that. Like, if you calculated the time, it is a minuscule amount of time. And I saw a fair amount of combat in my 7 months. So that means I spent the rest of that time working with people just in a quite frankly, a 9-to-5 sort of existence with a few exceptions. Mm. And I got to do that with some really funny and just kind of amazing people. At the time, the experiences could be a little bit exhausting, but in retrospect, there is a kind of, you start to laugh at a lot of that. My friend Ken and I, who Ken's in the book, him and I, we brought ourselves to tears and laughter. We're talking about, silliness, just nonsense about the experience and things that you can't really get anywhere else. And I'm grateful to have done that. And I'm always going to be a little bit proud to have been in that world, as painful as it can be sometimes.
You mentioned the dubious beginnings of that war, and obviously towards the end of the book, there's a sort of a sense of disillusionment on why you're there. How pervasive was that within among your comrades?
You know, the general attitude, and I think it was one that I espoused to a certain degree, was we had no ability to control foreign policy, only how it's executed in our within our worldview. You know, I think it was General Mattis who came up with the phrase that, you know, the United States military is effectively responsible for the last 1,000 meters of foreign policy. Hmm. So that's the last kilometer, you know. Everything else is a civic responsibility. So that means that our leaders who we elect and the people who elect them, that they own that war. And we are just responsible for executing the policies that they've asked us, that we've decided for ourselves. And so I had friends who, you know, who came from incredibly patriotic backgrounds by any measure, who questioned that war, the Iraq war especially. You know, they were very much, they had a lot of doubts about its necessity and its, you know, its moral standing. But they still did their jobs, because we had no way to not do so would have been worse.
Of course, that conflict may be mostly over, almost over from the U.S. point of view, but still the effects of that conflict are still with us in our society. As we approach Veterans Day, what does the United States need to do to make good on the promise it has made to veterans? I assume you got education out of the military, but for those that came home with injuries, with mental or physical injuries, what does the United States need to do as we approach this Veterans Day?
You know, I think the real thing I would ask people to do is just allow them to exist without any kind of stereotyping of their experience. I think one of the hard things about coming back and leaving the military was you never really escaped the stereotypes of being a veteran. You know, we have a lot of assumptions about veterans that I think are really reductive. You know, I've seen TV shows where like a sitcom, for instance, I saw once where they had a person playing a veteran who was quite frankly insane and was used as a comic relief. Mm. And I don't get offended by that necessarily, because I understand what they're attempting to do. But at the same time, it is a deleterious position to take. Like, it is incredibly alienating to come home and find yourself being typecasted, especially when you're trying to move on from it into other things. You end up getting siloed to a degree. And I think that's one thing I would like is, one, listen to what they have to say, and two, allow them to expand beyond that experience.
The name of the book is Volunteers, Growing Up in the Forever War. Jared Alexander, thanks very much for joining us.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Jared Alexander is a Marine Corps veteran who served from 1998 to 2006 in posts ranging from Iraq to East Africa. He's now written for Esquire, Rolling Stone, and The Nation and others, and he's the author of Volunteers, Growing Up in the Forever War. It's published by Algonquin Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.